All right, let's have an AA meeting. My name is Julie and I'm an alcoholic. Welcome to the Monday Night Blue Chip Speakers Meeting at the NABA Club, where a member of Alcoholics Anonymous with 1 year or more sobriety tells his or her story.
Hey everybody, I'm Tim. I'm an alcoholic. I'm going to read something from page 29 of the Big Book. Each individual in our personal stories describes in their own language from their own point of view the way they establish their relationship with God. These give a fair cross-section of our membership and a clear-cut idea of what has happened in their lives. We hope no one will consider these self-revealing accounts in bad taste. Our hope is that many alcoholic men and women in our room tonight and listening later on AABlueChipSpeakers.org, desperately in need, we hear our speaker, and we believe that it is only by fully disclosing ourselves and our problems that any of us shall be persuaded to say, yes, I'm one of them too. I must have this thing. I love our speaker we have here tonight. I wanted to get him for a long time. He had some health issues and things, but I was thinking about Ed. I think as much as anybody I've ever heard in this program, when I hear him, I hear the joy of sobriety. And that joy is not necessarily contingent on what's going on around you. It's going on. He has an infectious sobriety. That's the best way I can describe it. I hate long introductions, but he knows he's at home here, so please help me welcome Ed.
Ready to go? I'm Ed Hart, I'm an alcoholic. When I got here tonight and I saw the podium, I said to Tim, I said, I have problems with my legs. I don't know if I can stand while I tell my story. And he said, I got a cool bar stool here. We can put it behind the podium. I said, I've fallen off so many bar stools. Let's put me at a table where I can sit down like a normal person. I want to thank Tim for asking me to speak tonight, and I want to thank Tim R. for walking me through the vetting process that they have here. You know, these guys are tough. You know, I can see asking me my home group and data sobriety, but when they start asking about, do you have a valid license, what's your FICO score and that, you know, I don't know if I was telling my story here or auditioning for an episode of Cops, you know. But anyways, you know, NAB has been a big part of the AA in Atlanta for a long time, and for me it's really a privilege to be able to speak here. You know, when I first came in, I spent a lot of time in these rooms. And NABA was a great place to get sober. Everything was who's your sponsor, what step you are, you know, what service work you're doing. Everything was wrapped around it. With a lot of good old timers that were willing to spend time, you know, guys like Joe P. and Bill R. and Bob Carver. Sorry, I'm trying to stay away from last name. But Dick H. and Larry K. and just a whole raft of people who are really there to help newcomers coming in and giving you, a helping hand, you know. And it was a great place to get sober. I'm originally from Massachusetts, a town called Chelmsford. It's outside of Lowell, just north of New Hampshire. It's right on the Massachusetts border. I have my father. I never saw my father take a drink, and I have a brother, younger brother, younger sister. Neither one seemed to have a problem with alcohol. My mother made up for the rest of us. She was a raging alcoholic, and you know, this was back in the 40s and 50s, and you didn't hear much about AA at that time. You know, I understand. You know, there's a group now in Sandy Springs, and they're starting to redo the 12 steps. And the first step is now we admit we were alcohol, powers over alcohol, and our lives have become unfashionable. And, you know, it's kind of, that's, you know, today it's by kind of a mark of honor if you go to Betty Ford Clinic. You know, it's a status symbol, you know. But that wasn't the case when I was growing up. There was a boxing camp in the next town called Dropkick Murphy's, and it was where the fighters worked to train out. And every once in a while, you'd hear about some businessman. They would send him up to Dropkick Murphy's for drying out. No AA program, just keep him off the booze for a while, do some road work, work them out, sweat it out of him, and put him back on the street. And Joe P., who was a longtime member of Skyland and a very active here at NABA, we were talking one night, and I said to Joe, I said, "Do you ever hear of Dropkick Murphy's?" And he started to laugh, and I said, "What's so funny?" He said, "That's where I met my wife." He said, "My wife family has some connection to Dropkick Murphy, so that was up there getting dried out when I met Elaine. Probably the worst thing that ever happened to Elaine, but anyways. But anyways, my mother was, you know, off the rails as far as racing, and I couldn't stand her. I hated to be around her. And my father had a little clothing store. When I wasn't active in school or sports or whatever, I hung out with her. I did everything possible to stay away from her. You know, growing up, I didn't do a lot of drinking through high school, and nor did any of the guys I ran with. We all were active, all decent students. We all played ball, all had girlfriends, all had a set of wheels. You know, that kept us pretty busy. I got out of high school, I was a decent student, and I got accepted to Boston College. And I nearly flunked out the first year because there was no way I could get any studying done at home. And even though we only lived 30 minutes away from Boston College, I convinced my father to let me live on campus. And right away, things changed right away. My grades picked up. I got to end up being, you know, dean's list, good student and all that. Had a lot of good friends. And again, none of the guys I ran with did a lot of drinking. You know, BC was like most college. There was a lot of drinking going on. None of us were really into it. You know, we drank once in a while, but there was no, drinking was not a big deal. In fact, you know, most people when they get to AA, they stop drinking. Well, when I get to AA, I started drinking, you know. Now, I should explain that. When I got out of college, I went to work for Arthur Anderson and Company, and it was a major international accounting firm, and I went to work for them in New York City, and in the business circles, it was referred to as AA. You know, who do you work for? I work for AA. And I was only there about 2 weeks, and the guy said to me, "Do you want to join us for happy hour?" I don't know what the hell that was, but it sounded okay with me. And, man, it was love at first sight. I mean, I loved everything about it. I loved the camaraderie, the BS that went on, the babes in there and everything else. And, you know, we'd sit there reminiscing about the future, embellishing on our achievements, minimizing our failures. And we were all hot shots. We're all going to set the world on fire, you know. And, you know, at that time, drinking was not frowned upon at all with the companies like that. The thing was, you're supposed to be able to hold your liquor. You know, getting drunk was not a good idea. You know, we had booze at most company functions, and you just didn't want to be the first one there or the last to leave. You know, you went and kind of moderated your drinking. When you left it, you went out and got smashed, but you didn't in front of the rest of the people and all that. And I went to work for Arthur Anderson in 1961. And I did real well with them. I got a lot of, you know, promotions, and I was going up, moving up the ladder, and it was kind of up or out with those companies. Either you got promoted or you hit the street. And I was living in Manhattan, the Upper East Side. You know, I had a nice, you know, what do you call it, high-rise apartment with the doorman and all the trappings and all that. And it looked like, you know, I was doing pretty good. And I get to a point, I said, you know, no matter what I'm doing here, I couldn't see myself raising. I got married when I had my first child when I was in New York City. And I couldn't see myself raising a kid in the city. And Connecticut and Jersey, and that didn't turn me on. So I went to the human resources, and I said, I'd like to think about making a move. And they said, would you consider going to Puerto Rico? Well, nice climate, sounded good. So I went to Puerto Rico, sight unseen. I just moved the family down. I'd never been there before in my life, not even on vacation. But that didn't stop me from making the decision, right? You know, when in doubt, do it, you know. So I go to Puerto Rico, and it was a great opportunity because it was a small office, 100 people. There were like 15 Cubans, 80 Puerto Ricans, and 5 gringos, 5 Americans. And we took on a lot of responsibility, so it was a great chance to take on a lot of responsibility. And I did well down there. You know, I continued to perform well with the company. I was getting the record promotions. And it was another added benefit to Puerto Rico. All your stateside clients somehow found a reason to come to Puerto Rico in January, February. You know, just the fact that they were located in Chicago and they ended up in Puerto Rico in January, February, go figure, you know. And what they really wanted to do was get a company paid vacation, and to make it cheaper for them, they came and expected us to entertain them. Well, I mean, how stupid are them? We bought them drinks, put it on bill, billed it back to the company they were working for with some kind of a carriage charge on it. Okay with me. I was getting a drink for nothing. Their company was paying for it. It was fine. It was the same thing with Puerto Ricans in New York. You know, drink it was okay. You just didn't want to, you know, didn't want to make a fool yourself in the working environment. So again, I get good promotions. I was at a nice home in Condado initially. Then I bought a home in Bayamo, Rio Piedras area of Puerto Rico. Really a nice home. We had a living maid, a living gardener. I mean, a gardener, a living maid. In fact, when we sold the house, when we moved back to the States, the house became a consulate for one of the, I think it was San Salvador or somebody like that. So we were living a good life, you know, and I would have said, we got it knocked. My wife might have thought differently. We had two more children. We were in Puerto Rico, and I was constantly gone. If I wasn't working, I was drinking. If I wasn't drinking, I was golfing. If I wasn't drinking or golfing, I was working. I really had no time I didn't know how to be a husband. I didn't know how to be a father. It was terrible. I mean, so, I mean, I thought things were going great. She might have been different. But anyways, after a while, it was time to come back to the States, so I took a transfer to Atlanta, Georgia. So we moved from San Juan to Atlanta, moved into the Atlanta office of Arthur Anderson, and we had bought a nice home in Sandy Springs, new cars, great school district, all that. You know, a lot of optimism and that. And then things started to kind of go sideways on me. I got my first DUI, I think it was 1973, and I had 9 DUIs over the next 10 years. Now, this is when you can still buy them off, you know. Today, you'd be in a slammer. But in fact, my attorney said to me, if you get another DUI, don't even call me, because mothers against drunk drivers sitting in those courtrooms looking for somebody like you, you go in the slammer, so don't even call me. So I knew you'd tell me how I drank, went from 83 until I got in the program in 91, kept drinking without a DUI. Let me tell you, a lot of enablers and a lot of cabs and pins paid it out, because, you know, I just couldn't afford to get another DUI. But anyways, my career at Arthur Anderson started to stall, and I ended up leaving then. And over the next 15 years, I worked for a series of real estate companies, you know, some major ones. Cousins Properties was a lot of people you might have heard. It was an Atlanta-based company. Sam Zell was out of Chicago. He's the guy you see the talk shows with the Fortune 500s and all that. And with another guy, I built the Valley Apartments over in Sandy Springs and redeveloped Hidden Glen and stuff on 41. And I was, you know, I was still drinking up a storm, but I was, you know, kind of hanging in there. You know, I'd get in a little trouble and I'd bounce back. I always just seemed to be able to pull myself together and all that. And things at home were just in the tank, you know. I was never at home. When I was half in the bag and all that. Forget the point. I moved my wife and I tried to get back together again, and it didn't work. So I moved on. I went and moved over into one of the apartments that I owned over in Marietta. And try to get here. And then I joined to work for Zell, the guy out of Chicago, in the Atlanta office. And he decided to close that office because he decided he didn't want to be in. He wanted to be in the office buildings and apartments, not retail. I was buying shopping centers for him, so he decided to close the office. So, like everybody else, I decided to go out and, you know, went over to Office Depot, got business cards and letterhead, and I'm an entrepreneur. You know how that is. You're not self-employed; you're an entrepreneur. There's a big difference between the two. But anyways, but things I just couldn't pull it together. And I was living with this girl that I used to work for me, and things were going there, and she was the same, you know, and I could see why. I was still spending like I used to spend. I still belonged to a golf course. I was still playing golf 3 or 4 days a week, spending money like I had it, and I didn't have it. And things were just going down and down and down, and you know, I fell behind on my mortgage payments, and I did I'm a CPA, right? And I forget to file tax returns. Yeah, you didn't file. You don't forget. Yeah. How do you say you're I get notice from the IRS, and I write deceased and put them back in the envelope, like that was. If anybody wants to use that as a tax planning strategy, let me tell you, it's not a good idea. I just got to the point where I just couldn't get it together. I was going downhill and downhill. And the girl I was with, she was sick of me. I was sick of her. And I said to her, what are you saying? I'm going to get out of here. I got to get out of here. I think you're holding me back. And all this. Hold me back. I was trying to broker some real estate deals. And I made a few deals, believe it or not. But the problem was I was drinking around the clock. I had used to keep a bottle between my box spring and my mattress. But I needed a few pops just to get vertical, I couldn't get up without a little bit of help. And by 10 o'clock, I was too drunk to make phone calls. When you only work an hour a day, you don't make a lot of money in the real estate business. So I had a buddy of mine, and he had an office warehouse thing over on Jimmy Carter Boulevard. And I was working out there and using his phone and, thinking if I get out of the house early in the morning, maybe I could stay sober. It didn't do any good. I was just go to work with a jug in my car. So anyways, I'm there one afternoon, Friday afternoon, things are quiet, and all of a sudden I see this truck pull up in the front of the building. Everybody else had gone for the weekend, and it was 4 o'clock in the afternoon, and I'm still hanging out there. And all of a sudden this guy, I see he's putting stuff in the front of the building we're in. I'm getting golf clubs and bowling ball and clothes and a couple of chairs. And so I walk up and I say, what are you doing? He said, my mother says she never wants to see you again. She had downloaded all the stuff that I had in his truck and dumped it on the front lawn of this office warehouse complex I was in. I'm looking around and said, whoa, man, this is bad. I've got to make some moves here. So I was driving him. I'm driving a Mustang convertible at the time. That's not the most vehicle when you're going to move. That's not your vehicle of choice. So I dump everything I can into the Mustang. And I get at the end, I get this executive chair, one's on the rollers and all that. And that was the last thing I had. And the only way I could get it into the Mustang was put it into the upside down in the back. And I said, I've got to go over and talk to her because, something's wrong here. So I start going over there and I see all these people looking at me and I can't figure, why are they staring at me? Well, as I'm driving, the wheels on that chair were going like this. It looked like somebody with a homemade helicopter was trying to get it off the ground, And I'm thinking, man, this is not a way to keep a low profile, So I get up to the into the apartment complex, and the cop says, I knew all the cops by name because I wasn't in DUIs. I was having papers served to me, warrants and all this crap. And he says, Judy got a restraining order on you. You can't be within, 15,000 miles. But all I knew was this was not going to work. So I went back to the warehouse office, warehouse complex I was working out of. And I knew they had some empty bays, not the office portion, but the warehouse portion that they were vacant. They never locked those up. They locked up the office portion. So I go in and I find an empty bay, overhead door, pull the Mustang in. Hey, I got a new place to live, So I'm sitting there and I'm going, hey, this is pretty bad. At that time, I probably had about $200 to my name. That's all I had. The car I'm driving, the police are looking for it because I hadn't made payments on it, and they cleared. My ex called me one time. She said, the cops are looking for you. I said, what for? Oh, which ones? She said, all of them. I said, what do you mean all of them? She said, well, Cobb County, Fulton County, everything in the metro area. They were trying to track down the car so they could repossess it. And what I would do is, I would change the license plates. I'd go to, grocery store. Nobody would go and take it. I'd put it on the back of my car, And figure they'll never match up my car with that license plate. As long as I don't get stopped, I'm getting away with it. So anyways, I moved in the warehouse and I'm thinking, I got to do something here. I pondered it. We ponder a lot when we're drinking. I pondered this a lot. I don't know if I got a moment of clarity or what, but I said, maybe this drink is the best of me. So I called a buddy of mine, and I said, Bob, you had a problem with drinking. What did you do? He said, I went to AA. I said, really? This was a Tuesday morning, a Monday morning. I don't know, it was Labor Day, it was 91. I said, really? They're working? He said, yeah. I said, I'm going to stop drinking. I said, maybe I should do this. It's like 10 o'clock in the morning. Maybe I should do that. He said, well, if you want, I'll take you to a meeting this afternoon. So it's a club right up for me, the 8111 Club. Well, meet me there. Okay, that sounds good. 11 o'clock, I called back. I said, Bob, I think I'm overreacting. I don't think I'm overreacting. 1 o'clock, I called back. Bob, you're still going? This was on 2 or 3 hours, right? Finally, he said, look, I don't care what you do. If you want to go to a meeting, I'll take you. If you don't, that's up to you. And I'm not going to anymore. So I went to my first meeting at the 8111. I missed the whole thing because I was probably blown about a 2-3. You know, white chip. He said, how come you didn't make a white chip? I said, what are chips? I mean, I missed the whole chip ceremony. I mean, at that time, the 8111 had a metal blind going across on the Roswell Road side of it. I'm trying to keep a low profile again. Every time I turned around, I banged that metal blind. It was like cymbals going up. Boom! People would turn around and say, oh. Boy, you are not doing a good job of keeping a low profile. You made more noise than all of the other people combined. So anyway, so this buddy who took me in my first day, he contacted the girl who threw me out and said, you know, Ed's in bad shape. He's got no money. He's living on the street. And can you give him help? So she got me a room in the Claremont Lodge. Let me tell you something. That warehouse was safer than the Claremont Lodge. I pulled in the Claremont Lodge, and all night long, you could hear the cars going, the sirens going, and the flashing blue lights going on, and guys coming to my door going, Blank, Kenneth, who's the? Look, you know, I thought I was in a suburb of Mexico or something. I mean, there was nobody speaking English there, and I'm trying to get my stuff together and all that. So one of the guys at the 8111 said, hey, you're right around the corner from a clubhouse called Napa. You got to try Napa. So I said, it's okay. So the first time I pulled to Napa, let me tell you, you talk about intimidating. I pull in the driveway. I look at the building. This was something out of a John Gotti movie. I figured they're down there eating pasta and talking about who they're going to knock off in that low-slung building, you know. Who were the first three people I see, right? Larry Kay. He has the glass, and he doesn't know how to use the bifocal, so you cook it down and you're like this. Tim B. I don't know if anybody remembers Tim B. Tattooed up. It looked like some kid who forgot to take his riddle and Jim was all drinking. You know. Oh, yeah. And Harry with the satin jacket, Harry the hobo, I think we used to call him. He used to ride the rails. And I'm thinking, man, if I have to hang around with these guys to get sober, I'm in deep doo-doo. And I really was in deep doo-doo, but I didn't know any better. But, you know, they became what drink friends, you know, and all that. And I started, you know, initially I was going to 1 meeting a day, and then I went to 2 and 3 meetings a day. And I'd go to a meeting here, and I'd go to the 81. And I don't know, that car I had to run on fumes because I know I didn't have enough money to put gas in for the trips I was taking. But I was, you know, but I gave, you know, I was able to stop drinking first time since I could remember. And I credited that to going to meetings. So that was all I heard in the beginning, was don't drink and go to meetings. And my recovery was, I stayed MOCUS for a long time. You know, people are not familiar with that. It's moving slowly out of focus, MOCUS. I was MOCUS for the first 2 or 3 months. I remember I would talk to my sponsor. I said, hey, I'm going to meetings at Napa. They think you ought to work the steps. He said, Eddie, he said, I hate to bust your bubble. But there's some people see you at meetings, they're not even sure you've stopped drinking. You need more dry time before you start challenging the steps. But he said, I'll give you a suggestion. He says, take a certain time every day. And I don't give you do it morning, noon, or night. He says, just review the preceding 24 hours of your day and ask yourself, if I had those 24 hours to live over, what would I do differently? If I did something well, could you have done it even better? If you did something you're not so proud of, what would you do the next time? That was his introduction to me for taking inventory. And even today, I tell newcomers that I work with, I said, read those pages, 85 through 86 of the big book. You don't have to have any time in the program for that periodic, that little quota, that little period of quiet time to help Hugo. But yeah, anyways, you know, and so I went to a lot of meetings and a lot of, and I made sure I went to either a speaker meeting or a big meeting or a step meeting, and I avoided BB meetings. And when my daughter came out, I said, make sure you don't go to any BB meeting. She said, Dad, what's a BB meeting? I said, it says it's an AA meeting, but they don't talk AA. They just talk BB. And it's a, you know, it's BS is what there is. Make sure that when you go there, you get the AA message, and don't waste your time with non-AA meetings. So anyway, the other thing we did in the beginning, and I don't see it as much, tapes were a big thing. You know, you swap tapes, you know. There's so many tapes out there with good speakers like, you know, Sandy Beach and Clancy and, there's 50 guys out there that are all good speakers. And we swap tapes back and forth, and some are on step studies, and some are on just their story and all that. But everything was, you know, what meetings you go to, what steps you're on, you know, I listen to tapes and all that, you know. So I get, you know, get into the step work and all that after a period of time, and finally started to click in. My work life took me forever. You know, I watch people walk. People would say, oh, I'm doing the four step, and I'm still trying to figure out how to yell, we think not, at the end of the promises. You know, how do they know to say that? They go, it's the same every meeting. Really? Yeah. You know, I couldn't make the dots. I thought somebody was up there going, we think not, and I was missing it. You know? But I just wasn't connecting the dots. You know? And I really struggled. I made a few deals with the real estate and got a few bucks, but I just couldn't get it together. In the meantime, I moved into an apartment up in Sandy Springs, and somebody that made some money, I paid a little bit of the bills. But I was still struggling, you know. And I'm working. I had one of these sponsors who's so encouraging, so gentle and kind. You know, I'm working. Here I am. I'm 52, 3 years of age. Bad health, you know. Just not in good shape. And I'm working at color tile. I don't know if you know color tile. It was a ceramic tile and laminated flooring place. And the tractor trailer would come in the summer. It would be 120 degrees inside that tractor trailer. And up there schlepping ceramic tile and pergo and laminated wood and all that. And it was just killing me. I called my sponsor. I said, Matt, I said, this job at color tile is going to kill me. He gave me that smarmy shit, pardon me, smarmy. He said, yeah, but then you die sober. I said, yeah, man, if I come over to your office this afternoon, you're going to die sober. I don't want to hear that crap. I want to find me a job that gives me some money, not this crap about you're going to die sober and all that. But anyway, so, I mean, I didn't have time for that crap. You know, go do that somewhere else. Don't do it with me. But I was, you know, still trying to pull it together, and then, you know, bit by bit. But, you know, I got involved with the service work. You know, I always had a home group, and, you know, even today. And today, you know, I used to go to a meeting because I was afraid what would happen if I don't go to a meeting. And now I go to meetings to see the good things that happen. I still go to 4 or 5 meetings a week. Tells you what my social life must be like, right? But anyways, but it's a great way to, you know, get with friends and all that. By getting active, you know, if you look around and you look at PTA and Boy Scouts and that, you're going to find that 10% of the people do 90% of the work. And you just got to make up your mind you want to be part of the 10% of the 90%. And that's the way I look at it. I've been intergroup rep, GSR, treasured the Marietta Roundup for about 4 or 5 years, and I've just taken that job on for the new Marietta Roundup, which is coming up in May. Hint, hint, take flyers when you leave it and sign up for it. And I see Mary tonight. She says, oh, Ed, Hotline Ed. You know, that was, you know, I like to be called Handsome Ed, and she calls me Hotline Ed. And because I chaired the hotline probably for 8 years out of over a 12-year period. And that was a great service. You know, people don't realize that is, if Willie Nelson had been on the hotline, he would have had much more material than he did by hanging around those cowboys. I mean, some of the stuff that comes on, it's funny. I got a call one night, and the lady says, when is the AA going to have an opening? I said, I don't quite understand that question. She said, well, my husband says he knows he needs to go to AA, but there's no openings. I said, where? I said, let me, tell me where you live. But she gave me, I said, oh, Rebecca, just down the street from you, there's an opening tonight. It's been first open. Make sure you get in there at 7:30 before somebody takes it. Get him over there early. I'm sure that guy came in that night with a little buzz on. And, come on, honey, we're going on AA meeting. Well, I ruined his drinking. Yeah. Yeah. Another girl called up, and we could talk, and she'd been in and out for a while, and I said, were you a friend of Bill W.? She said, more like a passing acquaintance. You know, hey, there's some funny lines at AA. You know, the hotline give you some fun, you know. Anyway, so my sponsor says to me one time, he says, what are you going to do about the IRS? I said, I'm not going to do anything about the IRS. They're not bothering me. I'm not bothering them. He said, Ed, he says, you're going to get to a point where things, when you're at your lowest, the IRS will come up. You got to go see the IRS. So I, you know, got all my paperwork together, and I made an appointment to get out of the IRS. I walk in, and the lady says, oh, Mr. Hart, so nice to see you. It's not often we have people come back from the dead to visit us. I knew this was going to be a long day. But I got to tell you, if anybody's got any problems, or got IRS problems, I went straight up with them. I told them exactly what had happened. I got wrapped up in the booze and lost control and all that. Nobody could have been treated any better by the IRS than I was. I went in there, I owed them $125,000. The very fact that I showed up with all the back taxes and that, they cut those penalties and interest and that from about $125,000 to $75,000. Wiped out $50,000 just by me showing up. And that's progress. And I'll bet on the $75,000, if I paid them $30,000, that would have been a lot. The thing was, my daughters would say, Dad, we just deal with the IRS. I said, I don't want to know. I'd always be discouraged. I mean, and I would file, and I'd have tax refunds coming. The refunds would say, we applied this balance. I couldn't even keep track of it. I had so many years open with penalties and that. And then one day I had a refund coming, and I got like $14. And I said, holy mackerel, I have paid off the IRS. That's the only reason I got. And I never went back and tried to audit their work. I'm serious. Whatever I got, I was glad to have behind me. I was delighted and all that. But anyway, so, I mean, you know, I started hitting some licks, and, you know, I started doing some pro bono work, you know, guys, work with guys in a program. And that. I was doing a lot of tax returns for guys up at the 8111, you know, just for nothing. I'd just throw the numbers together and help them file a return. Until they heard my story about, you know, me dealing with the IRS, they wouldn't give me the work to do anymore. Anyway, I wasn't even paying for it, but they said, you're as wacky enough to file a deceased notice. I don't want you to do my tax return. So, I mean, that's all right. But anyways, I started to make some connections, and I started to get some decent jobs, and, you know, and I ended up having actually a pretty good career. I think it was really funny. I became a controller, of treasurer of a major real estate company, mostly in nursing homes. We owned a lot of nursing homes, and I had unlimited power to sign checks on the account. I was the chief financial guy, and we had gone through a major refinance sale of several of the properties. And we're sitting there with all the suits, you know, with the wingtips and the button downs, and all, everybody flashing the cross pen and pencils on that. And I'm executing wires for, you know, 35 men in this direction, 45. And I'm sitting there and I'm thinking, these guys only knew where I was about 15 years ago, living in a warehouse with no money. Would they be trusting me with $35 million? We think not. but I never did put the warehouse address on my resume. I have a philosophy. Never let honesty get in the way of good judgment. You know, there's certain things that best left unsaid. But anyways, I mean, AA has been great with me. I mean, I have a great life today. You know, I mean, I'm having a little some health problems. I just you know, I had some back surgery done, and I guess it's supposed to be PT, but PT, it seems to me, is just taking too long. You know, I don't talk much about my ex and my daughters and my story because I was a terrible father and a terrible husband, and I didn't have time for them. I didn't know how to be a father. And I didn't even want to try. You know, I was more interested. I would rather be drinking or playing golf than I would be spending time with them and all that. And when I got sober, I realized there was no way I could unring the bell. The damage that was done was done. There was no way to go and undo that. The best I could do was try to be a decent father and a husband going forward. And my ex had remarried, and he died a couple of years ago. And he left the estate just in a mess. And I was able to go in and kind of work with my daughters and working that all out and all that. And, you know, I was telling Mary, my ex has got dementia now, and she's now, you know, completely with it. And we had gone out, my two daughters and my ex, and we went to some kind of a show. And when I was dropping them off, my ex put her head back in the window of the car, and she said, "You seem like a very nice man." And she has no idea who I am. My daughter, who's in the program, said, "Dan, that means you don't have to do any one nice step. She doesn't even know you did anything." I said, "That's not quite the way it works and all that." But anyways, today I have a good, you know, when I say a good relationship with my daughters, I mean, I don't know how you have a great relationship with, you know, everyone wants to be, "Oh, I'm my child's best friend." I never thought I was my daughter's best friend. You know, I want to protect them, you know, and they don't go hand in hand. But, you know, getting them back in my life has been a learning experience. You know, one of the things I learned since, you know, getting sober, when a woman says to you, "We need to talk," that means you need to listen, you know. And I was always thought they wanted an answer. And my daughter said to me one time, "Dad, don't you realize when I ask you a question, I don't want an answer. I want a vent." I said, "Well, call your mother. She's in charge of that. I can't handle the venting side." But I got to tell you, it's you try to do the right thing. But thank God for caller ID. I mean, just sometimes that phone goes off and I look at it and go, "Oh, not that I can't handle it." So I make believe the phone stops working, I put it on buzz and silence and go to bed and worry about it. I'll wait till tomorrow to worry. But I tell you, A has been a great run for me. You know, I come in and I really wiped out. And, you know, to have this life I have today, I mean, how could I not be grateful? How could I not give back to this program enough? You know, if you take any situation, you go from where I was, 1991, broke, living in a house, car is trying to be refurbished, everything's gone, to where I am today, that only happens in three places: TV, movies, and AA. Because it's just, you look at it and it's incredible. And I don't sit there saying, "Yeah, look what I could have done." No, I just kept plugging along, but took things as they came, worked. Whatever suggestions I bought, if anybody said to try this, try that, I tried it. I had a lot of help along the way. I'm more than willing to help. You know, the newcomers come in, I'm going to reach up to them, encourage them, stick with it. Things will get better. And, you know, it's a great deal. You know, all you got to do is stick with it, and appreciate you give me a chance to talk tonight. And everybody was kind of polite, and not many people walked out. Last time I told my story, people walked out at 8:20. So either their hearing is better than yours, or you're more patient. I don't know. But thank you.
Thank you, Ed. I'll just keep going from here. How's that? Oh, you want to set me up? All right. All right, you guys can hear me. Ed, thank you so much. That was very entertaining and very enlightening as well, and I'm so glad I did not miss that. I have asked Julie to come up and hand out the chips. Hey, y'all. I'm Julie, and I'm an alcoholic. Grateful to be here. Grateful to be sober. Ed, thank you so much for your story. That was awesome. Here at NAVA, like so many places in AA, there's a chip system. And it denotes your time away from your last drink. If you're just coming in or just coming back from experimentation, or you're sick and tired of being sick and tired of being sick and tired, we offer a white chip. It's the International Sign of Surrender. If you just want to surrender just for today, come on up and pick up a white chip. All right. Anybody else for a white chip? All righty. After 30 days and nights, 30 long days and 30 long nights, without a drink, international symbol of handcuffs. You don't have to wear them anymore. Anybody want to come pick up a silver chip for 30 days? 30 days? Okay. If you make it to 90 days, your blood's running a little bit redder without the alcohol, and we offer a red chip. Anybody at 90 days? Right on. Right on. Anybody else for 90 days? All right, cool. 6 months, a little sunshine starting to show up. 6 months, awesome. That was good. Yeah. Anybody else for 6 months? 9 months get you a green chip. Anybody for 9 months? Come on, we're on the roll. Anybody with 9 months? Okay, how about 10 months? No, 9 months. All right. Anybody with an AA birthday, years or multiples, gets a blue chip. Anybody got a birthday? Oh, all right.
My name's Jim. I'm an alcoholic.
Hey, Jim.
Yesterday is my birthday, but I wanted to pick up a chip here. I just want to say that for many years coming up here, in this 11 years, it's a big deal. Thinking as a kid, coming up, picking up the chips. And, I mean, it's still a big deal, but it's the normal way of life. And that's probably the most important thing, the thing I'm most grateful for. But this is a normal life.
Any other blue chippers tonight? All right. I'm going to offer the white chip one more time because it's that damn important. And everybody deserves a second chance. Anybody want another white chip? Too high, too shy? Second chance. All right. Great. Well, congratulations to you and your higher power blue chip.
Thank you very much, Julie. Thank you one and all for joining the Blue Chip Speakers meeting tonight.
one I've never seen.